welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You know, I suppose we're part of the problem here at All Sides with Ann Fisher. We ask you to call us or email us or write to us on our Facebook page. And all of this while, we also want you to listen in rapt attention to what you're hearing on the show. Some of you just ignore all the pleas, of course. Good for you. Others among you are regular contributors via email and Facebook and the telephone. And thank you for that. But William Powers, author of Hamlet's Blackberry, is telling us to chill out. The technology is good, but too much of a good thing? Well, you know the rest. So he's with us today to talk about why we need a philosophy for living in the digital age. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Delighted to be here.
Why do we need a philosophy about living in the digital age? Why can't we just, like, chill out? And why can't we leave it at that?
Well, I think it would be nice if we could chill out and everything would take care of itself in terms of all these gadgets we've got and the way they're interrupting us and distracting us. But we've been at it for, you know, going on 15 years now. And in my opinion, it hasn't brought us to a really fantastic place. I love these gadgets and I have them and use them a lot, like anybody. But I was finding several years ago that it was really taking away a lot of the good parts of my life. And I felt like I needed a new approach. That's really all a philosophy is, an approach to life. So that's what I set out to come up with in the book.
You talk about the fact that, or you write about the fact that we already have an unconscious philosophy at work.
Yes.
The digital maximalism. I love that.
Thank you. Yeah, what that simply means is that I think we've been living by a philosophy without even realizing it, and it basically is this idea of maximalism, which is that the more connected you are by digital devices, or screens, as I call them for short, the better. Therefore, if you're connected all day and night, you're in the best possible position, and anytime you're disconnected from screens, you're in a bad position. And I think that philosophy is just bankrupt. I think our own experience and that little voice we have inside our heads is telling us, no, that is not the smart way to live. You don't want to be connected to people digitally all the time because it just doesn't bring out the best in us.
I suppose that's particularly hard for people who are the types that go to parties and go everywhere because they don't want to miss anything anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of person, we all have this in us. We all have a piece of this in us. I certainly had it in me, which is why I realized I needed a new approach. You know, it's part of being human. We want to connect. We want to learn from other people, have relationships with them. We need other people and connections to get by in life, for our work, for raising our families. It's crucial, and it's incredibly rewarding to connect. I mean, it's how we got to where we are. It's how we have these cities and civilizations and it's essential. But we also need time and space apart to make sense of it all and really to do something new with it, you know, to take all that stuff we learn and churn it into whatever we want to do with our own lives, you know, start businesses, have an inspiration for a book or a painting or whatever it is we do, you have to step back. And I think we're doing that less and less these days because of the gadget. And so we just need to come up with a different way of using them so that we're using them to the best possible effect.
Is it ironic that, you know, folks were predicting that the digital age would separate us from each other, and yet you opened the book in your foreword, your introduction, with the to asking us to envision ourselves in a room with a billion other people.
Yeah, I do this sort of fictional scenario because I sometimes think fiction is the best way to get at some point you're trying to make. So I open the book with this idea that we're living in a room where people are constantly tapping us on the shoulder and we can't get out of the room. There doesn't seem to be an escape. We're sort of trapped there. And that's kind of how I felt several years ago before I embarked on this book. And I sort of felt like I was yearning for that place outside the room. And I remembered what it was like from the pre-digital age. I was in college in the 1980s. I remember what it was like not to have a cell phone. And I wasn't sure how to get there or if we could get there. And so that's what I tried to address. But yes, there was a fear that the digital age would disconnect us because we'd be all hooked up to our gadgets, you know, and not be with each other in the best possible way. I think that's true in one sense, but in another sense, it's connected us too tightly. And we do have people, in effect, tapping us on the shoulder all day and night.
My guest is William Powers. He's author of A Practical Philosophy for Building, he's author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. You said it seems like uncharted territory, this digital landscape that we tread every day now, but the newness, it may be new, but it's not new.
Yeah, it's not new. This was something that I came upon in my research that I didn't expect when I was working on the book before I really started to write it. I decided to not rely on the futurists about where we're heading because the futurists are so often wrong, but instead to look at the past and to see if we could learn anything from previous technological periods and revolutionary moments, which this one certainly is. And as I started to look at these previous technological shift points or moments of flux, I discovered that people have been through experiences very much like what we're going through now many other times in history, and that they felt very much what we're feeling now, overloaded, overconnected, wanting a break, wanting a little bit of space for themselves. So I really started to focus on that, and in the second part of the book, I actually go to seven of those points in history, and I try and cherry-pick some of the best ideas that the thinkers from those times came up with. I look at one really smart person from each period.
Now, tell us about those periods. What are they?
Well, the first one, believe it or not, I go all the way back to ancient Greece, about 2,500 years ago, and the birth of written language, the alphabet, was just catching on in Greece around the 5th century B.C. And luckily, that was also the time when Plato was writing his famous dialogues and basically recording some of these fantastic conversations that Socrates had with his followers, where he was developing a new way of looking at the world, a new philosophy. And they really struggle in one of those dialogues with the question of the alphabet and written language. And Socrates says, you know, I'm incredibly worried about this thing. I think it's going to ruin our minds, the alphabet. That's not a direct quote, but in essence, that's what he said.
Right, right.
And Plato clearly, he doesn't say it himself, but Plato clearly didn't agree because guess what? He wrote the dialogue down using the alphabet, and we have it today for that reason. So that's the first moment, and then I go through, if you want, I'll just tell you quickly what the other bullet points are. And
yeah.
If you want, you can ask me. The next one is ancient Rome, when the alphabet had not only taken off, but this idea of empire was a new way of connecting people. The next one is the 15th century and the appearance of the printing press with Gutenberg. The next one is Elizabethan England in Shakespeare's time when people were actually feeling overload. Books had taken off, printing had taken off, and people were feeling terribly overloaded by that, and Shakespeare deals with it in Hamlet, which is the reason the book has the title it does, Hamlet's Blackberry. The next one is Ben Franklin's time, 18th century, when in fact there was not a new revolutionary device, but I focused on Franklin because he's one of the most overconnected people in history. He was really addicted to what we would call social networking today, but he did something fantastic with it. He figured out how to manage it really intelligently, and I talk about his strategies for doing that. The next one's the 19th century, Henry David Thoreau, who famously ran away from civilization, supposedly, at a time when the telegraph and the railroad were changing the landscape. But as I reveal in the book, he actually didn't run away. He was looking for some balance, and he found some terrific strategies that apply today. And then finally, the 20th century, the age of television that many of us still remember fondly. And there I focused on Marshall McLuhan, who we know for a couple of famous catchphrases, the global village and the medium is the message. But he had some subtler messages that I think we can apply today about how we can take control of this maelstrom that's around us of information and really build a good life and make the most of it.
You know, a lot of it revolves around the fact that we're afraid of being judged by others. We are afraid of looking like a slacker.
Yeah, you know, and even more broadly with that question, Anne, you point to this very interesting aspect of this that I try to explore in the book, which is the idea that we're taking our cues from the crowd. You know, we wake up in the morning and we really do want to kind of know what other people are doing, and we sort of think maybe we should be doing that. You know, it's kind of that natural human tendency to conform. And it is natural, but I think that if human experience teaches us anything over the last couple thousand years, it's that if you only conform and only do what everybody else is doing, you're not going to get anywhere in life. You really have to ultimately become your own person, stand on your own two feet, you know, figure out who you are as an individual and how to be happy as a person by yourself to really thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're connecting all day and kind of hanging out with the digital crowd, which is what we all do, and that's all you do, I think you wind up becoming inside your head kind of crowd dependent, and that can be a problem.
You wrote about, and I thought it was interesting how you put it there, that the digital sphere is all about differentiation, that anyone with a computer can have a blog now, and that the possibilities for self-expression are endless. But that the expression takes place entirely within the digital framework. So
right.
It's very limited in its own way.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a point that might seem like I'm slicing it a little bit thin, because the fact is, you know, you can be a person out there with a voice now, your own original
right.
voice, much more easily. And that is terrific. I love that. You know, there are literally billions of blogs now, according to what I've read.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fantastic. I mean, who can argue that that's a bad thing? It's a wonderful thing. And everybody should be expressing themselves to the fullest extent they can. But when you are expressing yourself in an environment where the crowd is constantly hovering around you, and literally on our screens, you know how it works, you're constantly getting interruptions from new incoming
mm-hmm.
from that digital world, and you're really not stepping back from the crowd effectively. It's hard. It's really hard and challenging to be that individual that you want to be. And if you're going to use these devices for these new opportunities for creativity and expression and being a voice, you know, on your own in the world, I think you have to step back and reflect and be away from the screen. And when you come back, you'll bring even more to the new medium. That's my thought.
We're going to take a break on that note. My guest is William Powers. He's author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There I go again. Or you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post a question or comment there, because I want it both ways. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
In commercial radio, in-depth means a minute 30. On much of public radio, you can hear stories stretched to 6 or 7 minutes. On Talk of the Nation, we're not talking in-depth until we've hit the half-hour mark. I'm Neil Cownan. Take your time with the discussion on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here from 2 until 4 on today's edition of Talk of the Nation, The Political Junkie in the 2 o'clock hour, and then an NPR News special at 3 on the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. That's this afternoon from 2 until 4 on WOSU 820, NPR News. Currently 68 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 75, clear skies tonight and a low of 54. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is William Powers, author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. You know, Bill, we've had some folks on from the Kiplinger program who have a digital media program at Ohio State University, and they're excellent. They're really wonderful about teaching about how to use it and how to use it to its best advantage, and make the point frequently that, you know, a lot of people, they're getting their news now from Twitter. They wait for somebody to tell them what's going on, or they're waiting for somebody to post something on Facebook. I like that aspect of it, but I also like to just pick up the newspaper and look at and see where my eyes take me.
Yeah, I like it too. You know, I'm on Twitter, and I love that you get the kind of the quick burst of this is happening and a chance to go to the link if you have the time, which mm-hmm. we often don't. But even those links that take you to a full story online, I find that reading on the screen, and I think this is established now in all the psychological studies that have been done, the reading on the screen is conducive to a much shorter kind of attention span. We have an impatience with digital reading that is different from reading off screen. And so although it's very unfashionable to say this, I think there is still an incredibly useful role for the hard copy newspaper and magazine, and for that matter, the book, in our lives, because it doesn't have that same, it doesn't impose that same impetus somehow in the mind to move on to the next thing. And there are all kinds of cognitive reasons for this that I talk about in the book that kind of encourage us to jump around on the screen. And it just doesn't happen on the page. So I find myself looking at the newspaper increasingly as a kind of oasis for slow thinking, for reflection, for really making sense of things in a way I just never seem to do on my laptop or other screen.
But are you spitting in the wind because some libraries are going bookless or they're going in that direction? Everything's going online. Is it too late?
I don't think I'm spitting in the wind. I'll tell you why. Because there's a theory about technology that's kind of widespread. It's almost a cliche that a lot of us buy into, which is that the new technology makes the old one obsolete. And the classic case is the buggy whip. You know, the automobile came along and suddenly the buggy whip had no purpose anymore. And that is true. The buggy whip did basically become useless for most people. But there are many cases where that is not the case. And in fact, the buggy whip may even be an exception to a larger rule, which is that older technologies are not always supplanted by newer ones, but in fact find new roles to play. And the case I use in the book, it doesn't sound like it's related, but I think it's a great analogy, is the hinged door, the door that opens on a hinge. Ever since the 1920s, science fiction movies have been telling us that in the future, there will be no hinged doors. It will be all sliding doors. If you watch any science fiction movie, they always have these sliding doors.
Or they float or they disappear.
Yeah, and 10 or 20 years from now, we're always being told that's what the world's going to be like. Guess what? It's almost a century of that now. It didn't happen. We still have hinged doors. Question is why? The reason, and people have looked at this, people have actually studied this question of doors. The reason is that doors do things for us that hinged doors, that sliding doors don't. They're more expressive. We can slam a door in anger. We can close one quietly out of concern for a child. We actually like the way hinged doors work in our culture. And that's why they've lived on, even though in a sense they don't make a lot of sense. You know, they take up all that space when you open them. Sliding doors are so much smoother and more efficient. And I think that analogy carries directly over to digital. There's all kinds of wonderful things digital does for us, and it's going to dominate huge parts of our lives. But I think going forward, the more connected we get by these gadgets, the more there is going to be an incredible utility and even a joy in using something that is relatively disconnected, like words printed on a sheet of paper. And I find that already. I go off with a newspaper, and I'm in a whole other state.
You talk about that, too, is in terms of your son and wanting to draw. I think it's your son wanting to draw on the computer and use the computer tools. And you said, well, how?
It was a drawing program.
As a drawing program. And you said, well, what about just grabbing some crayons and doing it on a piece of paper over here at the desk?
Yeah, this is a funny
little story. It's like, whoa.
We were going off to a holiday at my mother's house. I think it was Easter, and we were going to be driving to her house. And my son suddenly had this inspiration that he wanted to do some kind of a little piece of art for her. And he was only about 6 or 7 at the time, I think. And he immediately made for his Mac and was going to do it on one of these programs. I think it was called KidPix, which he loves and we love, and it's a lot of fun to do this on the screen to draw things. But since it was a present for his grandmother and it was going to be theoretically printed out, and we knew that those don't have the quality of a hand-done piece of art on a piece of paper, we said, hey, why don't you just do it right here with these markers? And she'll be able to really see what you did with your own hand rather than what the screen did. Well, he tried it, and he was totally converted. You know, there's this idea that these kids only want to do things digitally. It was a revelation to him to do it that way, and he loved it. And that's not to say we should just go back to magic markers and not use the screen for art. People are doing fantastic art on the screen. But I'm saying there is a role in our lives for both. And stuff that happens here in the third dimension, like drawing with pencils and crayons, is still a joy, and I really don't think it's going away.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call. Fred, you're on the air. You want to talk about the pressures of life in the late 19th century.
Yes, I was just wondering if your author had just sparked some memory for me. He talked about periods of our history where the stress of new technology has caused people to comment. I'm wondering if he has read anything by Silas Weir Mitchell, and his book called Wear and Tear was written in the 1880s, and from my point of view, it's like, what is this man complaining about? But he's talking about how life is so stressful in the 1880s. And I just was wondering if that was something that you'd run across, because it's a great little book to read if you want to add to your commentary, I think.
Thank you. Yes, you know, I did look at that period pretty intensely. I have a whole chapter about that period, and you're exactly right. There were all kinds of people. I don't remember Mitchell per se. But I read a number of people from that period who complained about how civilization was basically going down the tubes because everyone was over-distracted,
right,
and overloaded.
He was a physician, and turned out he was also a novelist, kind of a Renaissance person, very famous. And he came up with the rest cure, which confines you to a bed for months and months, and you're not supposed to move, and you're not supposed to have your relatives come see you because that's what's stressing you out.
I love it.
And then gradually you get, he takes you through several stages of recovery until you're a real human being again.
I love it.
And but I remember one of the things he was kind of upset, a sign of the modern age was the education of girls.
Yes.
Which he said, they can't really take it. Why are we doing this to them?
Yeah, you know, there was another guy at that same period. His name has slipped my mind, but he was, and he's not in the book because I focused on just one thinker from that period, Thoreau, but there was another person who was a celebrity doctor in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, in Manhattan. He was kind of like almost the Dr. Phil of that time. And he had similar concerns, and he had a book come out called American Nervousness. And it was all about this malady that everybody felt they were suffering from, this mystery disease that was all about living in a newly technical, newly industrial society, and basically that everybody was going insane as a result of this. And, you know, it's funny, the echoes are everywhere in history. Also in the 19th century, Thoreau, who I focused on in the book, talked about how people were addicted to the post office, to going to the post office over and over during the day to check their mail.
Isn't that funny?
You know, it was a new thing, relatively new, the post office. It had really been born as an institution in villages and towns around America in the 19th century. And the telegraph had arrived at just the same time. And in some cases, you could check the telegraph at the post office. And there was this notion that you just had, in some people's minds, that you had to check all day or else you were missing something. Ring a bell?
Yeah. Thank you.
Fred. At least you could get some exercise walking to the post office. I mean, now it's just, you know, you get, you know, carpal tunnel is, you know, all you have to look forward to.
It's true, but I love this point that Thoreau makes, and this is not a famous quote of his, but it should be, and where he says, the more, this is the paraphrase, the more frequently someone goes back to the post office to check their mail, the less in touch they are with themselves. You know, he's basically saying those people are their consciousness is constantly in that outward world, trying to figure out what the crowd is doing, what's my next connection, which, as I said, is a wonderful impulse that we all have. But if you're not in touch with yourself and that inner world that you need a little bit of quiet and space to get to, you're just losing out big time.
My guest is William Powers. He's author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, post a comment, question for Bill Powers right now. I love the opening quote of the book, speaking of Emerson, you know, speaking of quotes by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It says, "This time, like all times, is a very good one, if we but know what to do with it."
Yeah, I love that, and I used it because I really feel like there's no reason to be a pessimist in any period of history. You know, we're so lucky to be here and to have this time that we've been given, and it really is true that the optimists tend to have things work out happily.
Mm-hmm.
Emerson was an incorrigible optimist. I love that about him, and I really am kind of constitutionally an optimist, which is why this book is not a downbeat book about digital.
Right.
it's really about that idea that you can take the reins of your own life. And these technologies are fantastic. We really can do wonderful things. We already are. But we have to make sure that we're running the show. We don't want our screens to be running our lives for us, because then, we're, you know, it's not our lives, essentially. If we took ownership of this world of digital that we have and really, really knew how to use it to its best effects, I mean, we're headed for wonderful things, and I actually think we are.
When you're checking your emails or checking your Facebook or going through your, you know, your Twitter list, you're not doing something else. When you're rushing to the post office, you're not at home doing something at home that you could be doing.
Yeah. Everything you decide to do is really a decision not to do all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, there's a section where I write about office workers and the terrible situation they're in today, where they're toggling their attention constantly all through the day, from inbox to text to Facebook. As you know, many people now use Facebook for business purposes.
Mm-hmm.
All day long, these different screen-oriented tasks. And it feels very productive because in each case, whatever screen you're staring at, you are doing something. But when your activity is all about that toggle, back and forth, there's something you're not doing, which is taking that information that you're absorbing from the screens and turning it into something new and original and fresh in your own mind that you can bring to bear in your work. Research shows that when you move your attention from one device to another and then try to go back to the first task, there's a recovery time that is actually a multiple of how long you were away. I don't remember the exact number, but if you're away for 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
let's say it takes 25 minutes to recover your focus when you go back to task A. So essentially what we're doing all day is toggling and trying to recover and never fully recovering. Never getting to that place of real engagement with a task so we can do it in the best possible way. And that is a giant loss. Businesses are finally discovering they're losing money because of this, because of distractions.
I love the way you talk about our relationship with our pets, our dogs. And
yeah.
how, when you're out playing, and 'cause that's, you know, I completely get that with my dog. It's the best thing I can do is come home from work, put everything down, walk out into the backyard and throw the ball around for this ecstatic, you know, loving in the moment animal.
Yeah, I use pets as an example, partly because I have pets. I have a dog and two cats, and I have a great relationship with all three of them. And I use pets because our relationship with our pets is an example of something that I think still has a lot of focus and depth, partly because the pets are not asking us to be anything but with them in the moment. That's all they want. And they're not distracted by digital distractions the way we are, so they really do focus, and we have a kind of an incentive to return that focus. So in a way, I think that time you spend with your dog is kind of a wonderful example of how we could be spending our time and should be. Really, on everything we do, that kind of what I call serial focus, it's sort of like what a great surgeon does, where he goes from one operation, one surgery, to the next, but is completely focused on each one. You know, surgeons tend to be very busy people, but they have a method to it that really works, which is they're basically doing one task at a time, not this crazy multitasking mm-hmm. that doesn't get us anywhere.
Well, did you hear about the surgeons that were twittering?
No, I haven't heard about that.
The
is
surgery.
There a case for that?
I paused there because I did. I forgot. Is it tweeting or twittering?
Yeah, it can be both. I think.
It can be both. No, it's been checked. They were twittering. Now they had some of their junior partners in the operating room, and I think they were doing it, but they were kind of going back and forth saying, did you get this down, and what do you think of that? And it was a very dangerous surgery, and they did a beautiful job apparently, and everything came out great. But someone didn't remark when we were watching that you know, should they be doing that?
Well, you know, I can imagine that working if you have one surgeon doing the actual surgery, you know, or two, you know, actually on the body. And then somebody else is off to the side in charge of the tweets that maybe they're receiving from some distant colleague on another continent,
mm-hmm.
giving them tips. Perhaps that's what they were all about. And if that person with the tweets is really focused on the tweets and isn't also trying to, you know, remove a troublesome organ or something, that sounds terrific for me. But if you have one person doing all those things at once, that's where you run into trouble. You know, it is a proven fact. Human beings cannot do more than one or two things well, two at the most, at the same time. It just, we know this from experience. It just doesn't work.
Well, they were working on it, but every once in a while they said, how's it going over there with the guy tweeting? I mean, their mind was on it because at one point the operation became very dangerous and iffy. And, you know, this was being tweeted out there. And they were kind of concerned about that. But it was just, I guess, an extreme example of, you know, possibly where this is heading, what we're trying to expect ourselves to do. In the meantime, it's interesting. Do you notice friends and colleagues and that sort of thing kind of fall off of Facebook every once in a while or fall off of Twitter?
I have. They kind of disappear. Mm-hmm. And I've come to the point where I feel really happy for them.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, assuming nothing bad has happened.
Right.
I tend to assume the best.
Right.
They seem to have decided to take a break, take a respite, do something else, you know, and I love that. To me, I often imagine them kind of taking ownership of their life again and deciding I'm going to have a new approach, and maybe they'll come back in a new way to that medium. But what you said about the surgeons, Anne, also brings up kind of a general principle, which is that I kind of think in the last 15 years, we've been so caught up in the enthusiasm over these devices, which is totally justified because they're so powerful and have so much potential. We've been so caught up in it that we've kind of just bumbled around and run around without really thinking about the best way to use them. And going into the future, I think what we need to do is simply be more mindful and intentional about how we use them. So if you're a surgeon and someone proposes you tweet in the operating room, before you decide to do that, think to yourself, is this going to serve my highest purpose for this task? When you get home after a hard day at work, your screen is there, perhaps in your home office or the kitchen waiting for you. But so are your kids. Is going right to the screen serving your highest purpose as a parent, as a spouse? I don't think it is necessarily, especially if you've been on screen all day. Why not be with your family at home instead of staring at the screen?
We're going to take a break right now. My guest, William Powers, Hamlet, author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. How do you manage your digital life, and how do you balance it with the rest of your life? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I feel like such a hypocrite. Or go to Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and tell us what you think there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Capital City Radio is the new HD radio service from WOSU. Get an eclectic blend of blues, rock, world, folk, and alternative country on Capital City Radio, which means an opportunity for great musical discoveries 24/7. Keep up with the local music and concert scene with shows like Groundswell Columbus and Capital Noise. Listen to Capital City Radio on WOSU HD3 89.7 FM or online at capitalcityradio.org. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here. The U.S. leads the world in the number of inmates in prison or jail, and a majority of prisoners are African American or Hispanic. Hear why an Ohio State University law professor says mass incarceration in the United States has become the new Jim Crow. That discussion at 11, right here on WOSU 820. Currently 69 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Sunshine today, a beautiful day with a high of 75. Clear skies tonight and a low of 54. Sunshine for tomorrow as well and a high of 75. All this week on WOSU 820, it's NPR coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. Join Linda Wertheimer at the end of each day for a one-hour summary of the day's proceedings. That's NPR coverage of the confirmation hearings all this week at 7 p.m. on WOSU 820 NPR News. All Sides continues. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new addiction, the digital age, and can you kick it or not? We have a call right now, 614-292-8513. If you want to join the conversation, Mike, you're on the air. You have a joke.
Well, I'd like to recite a little bit of Hamlet in reference to Hamlet's blackberry. To E or not to E, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the spam and email of outrageous friendsters or to take arms against a sea of tweeters and by the leading end them.
I love it. Terrific.
By the way, that's a little thing to Jerry, a frequent caller who always has great insights and occasionally a bit of poetry. So
right.
A little comment to him. Thank you.
That's very nice, Mike. Thank you.
I love that.
Yeah.
You know, if I may, and I do actually talk about Hamlet in the book, and there is a moment when he talks about how his mind, in the play, when he talks about how his mind is too crowded with information and too distracted. He refers to his head as this distracted globe. And in the play, Shakespeare even suggests kind of a way to battle that problem, which people used in Elizabethan times. They had a little device that helped them kind of clear their minds. So the times haven't changed all that much.
You say that we don't turn inward as often or as easily as we used to. It's almost sounds like there's a physiological change, like we can't.
No, I really think we can. I just think what happens is that we get in this connected mode, and we get that juice, you know, kind of flowing in our heads, the kind of the quote from the New York Times that's been floating around lately is we get a dopamine squirt inside of our brains. We get this kind of thrill of connectedness. And once you're on it, it's a bit like a drug, and you can't get off it. But I find that if you take a day or two, in my case, it takes kind of two disconnected days, say on a weekend, really to ramp down the connectedness and do as little as possible. It all comes back. That whole other mode of thinking, slower, more patient, more reflective, comes right back. And I can sit with a good novel and stay with it for 2 hours and not feel I have to go check my inbox.
You call it the Internet Sabbath.
Right. Yeah, my family has a ritual that we started. We're in our fourth year now, so it actually predates the book. And we just felt we were all too connected. We were falling into this habit that I call the vanishing family trick, where we would gather in the living room after dinner to have family time. And one by one, we would peel off on some flimsy excuse. I have to check something. I need a glass of water. And, of course, you know where we're all going. We're all going to our screens, which are in different corners of the house. And we would never come back. The family would vanish from the living room, and we'd be with the digital world the rest of the evening. So my wife and I decided to do something about it, and we came up with this idea of the Internet Sabbath. Disconnect the modem on Friday night, and it stays disconnected till Monday morning. No Internet. Our computers are all offline, and it really has changed our lives. It gave us that two-day break every single weekend, and it kind of changed the whole week because we have that break. Our connected time is more pleasant and productive. It's a wonderful solution for anybody who has the freedom to do it, which not everybody can. You know, it depends on your work life and so forth. But since we're both writers, we were able to do that.
Your son, what about homework, that sort of thing? Do you see that? Or does he go to the library if he wants to do it?
Yeah, we had to set up all kinds of rules. One rule was that if you had a really urgent need for an Internet task, on the weekend.
Like to check the movies.
Yeah, check the movies. not check the movies, but in his case, homework. Or, you know, my wife has had a few work-related emails she had to do on the weekend that she just could not avoid. Our rule was you go to the public library down the road. And they have terminals that you can use. And therefore, the house itself remained this kind of disconnected sanctuary on weekend days. I also concede in the book that we had some times when we really made an exception. I'll give you an extreme one. There was a hurricane bearing down on where I live. I live on Cape Cod, and we had a hurricane coming on one of our disconnected weekends during the Internet Sabbath. And my mother called. She lives several hours away, and she said, "Are you evacuating? People are evacuating. I just saw it on TV." And we decided that this was a case where it did make sense to plug in and check the latest, you know, storm images on the Internet and, you know, figure out if we should evacuate. So we did plug in that extreme case. It's not like we are being completely dogmatic about it, but I'll tell you, it is a ritual that has served us so well that we all now look forward to the Friday unplug, including my 12-year-old son.
You talk about distance, and Plato talks about distance, I guess, and the value and how that the recovery time when there's distance, and I guess Internet Sabbath, the weekends off, are something like that. But you talk too about it in terms of jury duty, which I related to very quickly when I did jury duty.
Yes. You mean that it gave you some distance?
Yes. That I wasn't – at first I was frustrated because I couldn't be at work. And then, well, you always have your computer. And it wasn't until I, you know, dragged my computer there one day, I realized I didn't have a way – I forgot to find out how to get into my email from work.
Right.
And everybody else is just jumping into their computers and their emails. And, you know, you have just an hour for lunch, and they're just jamming that whole hour. And I couldn't. And I was – it was nice.
Well, in my case, it was one step further than your jury experience. In my case, this was a federal jury I was called to in Boston. I tell this story. And they had a rule at the federal courthouse in Boston: you can't bring any devices into the building. So, and when we arrived for jury duty the first morning, we had to give up our cell phones and our laptops to an armed guard at the door. And we spent most of the day together, 75 of us, completely disconnected in this building. And it was a revelation. It was so interesting how different the space we were in felt. Our interactions felt different. We were really present. We were really there in a way that I find, you know, many of us are not present anymore. And I tell the story just to make the point that why should it take armed guards and a federal law for us to get to that place? You know, it's such an important place to be. I think we can get there on our own and that we should be doing that more often. And that's why I sort of propose this new practical philosophy that can help us do that.
It would be nice to think that the armed guards and the federal law was put in place to, you know, help with that, to execute your philosophy, but...
It wasn't. Although, I do think there's an element of it. You know, obviously there's other reasons why they want jurors to not have those devices, but I think there is an element of it where you need people on juries to be focused. And so it also does serve that purpose. You really want, if you're a juror on a murder trial, you really want that person to be there and thinking about it. And I didn't wind up being chosen for the jury, so I don't know. But just that one day I spent there, I could see that it would actually make for a better jury.
Have you ever been chosen for a jury?
No, that was actually my first time ever called.
Yeah, I can't get it. Once you're a journalist, I think it has something to do with it. Marshall McLuhan talks about lowering the inner thermostat.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Yeah, as I said at the outset, McLuhan is known for these kind of catchphrases.
Mm-hmm.
But some of his best stuff is the not cliche stuff that is less known. And he was into the idea that media technologies have different effects on us, and he used temperature as his metaphor. And he said there are hot media that kind of fill up our minds with information to the point where we aren't really contributing anything actively. We're just kind of receiving and trying to deal with it all. The crowded mind, it's also called by another philosopher in the book. And then there's the cool medium that kind of opens up more space in the mind and invites more participation from us and more of our mind kind of engaging. And so I talk about developing strategies where, A, you figure out which devices cool down your mind, and then using those when you need it. And in all honesty, Anne, one device that is a real cool one for me that helps me kind of notch down a little bit and relax is the radio. In McLuhan's time, the radio was considered hot because it was new and people felt all flooded with information, audio, you know, one sense was all filled up with words and noises and so forth. But today, because the radio is audio only, no images, no interactive keys, I think it is an amazing vacation for the mind, and I enjoy radio all the more.
It's a survivor.
It is. You know, in the 50s, radio was supposed to be dead. It was
right.
Supposed to be on its deathbed, not going to last. It's another example, like what I said about the newspaper and the Hinge.
Right.
Where I think a lot of times these obituaries are premature.
614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment, you can go to email at allsides@wosu.org. And some folks are getting on the old Facebook page there, I see. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. What did Benjamin Franklin do? You talk about his positive – you talk about positive rituals. Now, I imagine that your Internet Sabbath is one of those But what did he do to check out?
Yes, our Sabbath is something that is very Franklin-esque. He believed in positive rituals. That is, instead of coming up with a ritual to fix some addiction or some habit of yours you don't like, instead of coming up with a ritual that's negative, and an example is something a lot of companies have been trying, No Email Friday, they call it, which to me is not a very smart name for a ritual because all it sounds like is you're taking something away. His ritual was he came up with this list of virtues that he wanted to achieve in his life, and they were all really positive names. So instead of saying no alcohol for Ben because he loved his drink, he said he was aiming for temperance, which, by the way, does not mean giving up alcohol. It just means taking alcohol in moderation. And he did that for all these habits that he was trying to break in his life because he felt he was too overextended and essentially going off in too many directions. He made a list. He created a little grid on which he kept track each day of how he did in pursuing these positive goals. And he carried it with him his entire life from when he was in his 20s to his 80s. And when he wrote his autobiography toward the end of his life, he chalked up all his amazing successes, and we have to think he was one of the most successful people in history, to that ritual, to carrying those positive goals around with him. And so in our case, we treat the Internet Sabbath not as something that's being taken away from us, but something that's being gained. We think about all these fun family times we have together, doing stuff not on screen, and all we get from that on the weekend, and how much it's enriching us. In the beginning, I'm not pretending it was easy. It was very hard in the beginning. We had total withdrawal, all of us. But because we had positive goals and we kept reminding ourselves we're shooting for this, we're shooting for A, B, C, more time walking down to the ice cream shop, you know, good stuff that we wanted to do, it really kept us on track until we got to that place where it became effortless.
Jonathan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment about how multitasking, I think that's the big skill of the future, dealing successfully with multitasking. I'd like to talk specifically about the career like air traffic controllers, who used to be a much slower business than you would, you know, you'd watch one screen and you'd be in control of far less aircraft. But now these people are continually being pushed to be more efficient and are watching more and more planes and more screens. And if you're not capable of doing that adequately, you're pushed out of the business. So I'm wondering whether you think that each one of these technological, let's say, periods of advancement, are they pushing humankind forward towards some more efficient type of human being? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It's a great question. I think it's fantastic that the caller brings up the example of air traffic controllers, because that is a case of a business that figured out a long time ago that its workers were having trouble with multitasking and they had to do something about it. And interestingly, what they came up with in air traffic control was the use of slips of paper to represent airplanes. They move these slips of paper around so they have a physical embodiment of the airplane instead of just or in addition to what's on the screen. And my understanding is they still do that in air traffic control today. Another example of the older technology living on because it's still useful.
Yes, but my real part of my question is, and I haven't read your book is yet, in each of these technological periods, did it seem like humankind was being pushed towards the envelope?
You mean kind of like evolving?
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, sorry, I misread the question. Yes, I think there is a sense of that happening in every era, but what I found in my research, and I write this, is that, in fact, if you look across history, people actually really remain essentially the same. Human beings are consistently human in most ways in the same way from era to era. That's why when we read Plato today, it feels so accessible and useful, even though it was 2,500 years ago, because I think we don't wind up, in a sense, rebuilding the brain. The brain is plastic, and the brain can adapt to new situations very well, but we don't make a new human being because we have new technologies. We remain who we are as human beings, and we figure out the best uses for those technologies for our lives. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank
you. You bet.
Sure.
Thank you.
Ted, you're on the air. You want to give us a personal experience. Goody.
Well, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm listening to this as I'm driving in my car, and I just reminded me of a story many years ago. I worked for, well, our local zoo, and I had to carry a walkie-talkie all the time. All the time. It was, you had to stay connected all the time. And I was having lunch with my dear sweet aunt, who's a former clinical psychologist. We were just chit-chatting, and I just said, it's so frustrating. I can't even get away from this machine to sit and eat lunch. And she just kind of reached across the table and patted me on the hand and said, sweetie, does it have an off switch? And I thought, oh, yeah, I guess it does. She said, turn it off. And I think we sometimes forget. We can turn it off. We just need to stop a minute and turn it off. And I just thought that was relevant to the conversation. And thank you very much. Great show.
Thank you, Ted.
Okay.
I think it's very interesting. When I was an editor, we had walkie-talkies. We could, I don't know what phone company that was. Do you remember, Bill, that you could talk walkie-talkie-like on your phones?
Yeah, I forget the name.
And I tortured my reporters. And I just know that they hated it. But it was so easy to do, but they hated it. And I look back on that now and I could slap myself. So,
well, you know, but in the case of a reporter who is trying to stay up with the latest,
mm-hmm.
and the editor may be helping them with that, that does make sense.
Yes.
But the caller's point, I love his point about the off switch, because it's so true. It's so simple. You know, in my family's case, it's just flicking off the modem on Friday night, and it works wonders. But in a broader sense, that situation he had with the walkie-talkie at the zoo, we're all being thrust into that now. And the question is, does adding that technology to the given task really help? And if we have time, I'll tell one quick story about this.
Well, we have about maybe 10 seconds.
Okay. Well, I heard about a school administrator who loved welcoming the kids in the morning as they got out of their cars. And then he was given an iPhone and required by the school board to have that there. And it kept distracting him from the task of welcoming the kids, taking away the best part of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it didn't serve the highest purpose.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Bill Powers, author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Thanks so much for being with us today. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks, Ann. It was delightful.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.